Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Good news. Jobs added to the U.S. economy. The Labor Department says 257,000 jobs were created last month. Hourly earnings took the biggest jump since 2008. The Labor Department report also revised the numbers in December and November higher. By itself, November job growth at 423,000 beats all the monthly numbers for the past 17 years. The unemployment rate now stands at 5.7%, squeaking up from 5.6% last month. But economists say the better number to watch is labor force participation. That's up, and that's a sign that some of the hardcore unemployed are seeing some benefits in the steady economic growth. And we could throw a party over these numbers, and we will have a party, but not about that. Today would have been Bob Marley's 70th birthday. We will remember Marley and the happy, hopeful global sound of reggae music a little later in the program. Here's a tease.
Well, all right, we're jamming. I wanna jam it with you. We're jamming.
But let's focus back on jobs. How hard will it be to get beyond this mid-fives plateau in the unemployment rate? It might be quite difficult, even though there are a lot of people who, in theory, could easily enter the workforce, but for a little checkbox on a job application asking about past criminal records. According to the National Employment Law Project, an estimated 70 million people have something on their records that could show up on an employment background check. If an applicant checks the box that says they were once convicted of a crime, the chance of being turned down goes way up. Some states have passed laws banning the checkbox, and Jared Bernstein wants a national ban. He's former chief economist to Vice President Joe Biden and a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, author of the forthcoming book, The Reconnection Agenda, Reuniting Growth and Broadly Shared Prosperity. Jared, welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So what do you think a job applicant faces when they see that box on an application?
What I think they face is a considerable discrimination, but we actually know this, at least from some research that suggests that men with previous criminal convictions work fewer weeks than people who don't. They earn 40% less than similar non-offenders, and their earnings are less than half compared to people who haven't faced incarceration.
And this is because they don't get jobs, or once they're on the job, the fact that they have this record means employers are far less likely to give them hours?
Well, it's both. And if you can't get a job, it's obviously hard for you to build up the kind of experience with which you usually gain pay advantages over time. So they interact in a negative way.
How many people does this affect?
Over 70 million people have a conviction or have some history of an arrest that can show up on a routine background check for employment. Over 70 million. Now, some of those folks actually didn't commit a crime at all. It's just that there was an arrest made that was later reversed. But they still, because of some pretty sloppy record keeping, could face a background check and still have an arrest history.
Now, if you are an employer, isn't it in your interest to know if someone's been convicted of a felony?
Absolutely, and not just a felony, also lesser crimes. And in fact, I don't know of anyone in this business that I'm talking about, which is trying to help give those folks a better chance, who's saying employers shouldn't know. What we're typically talking about is that employers don't need to find out right off the bat because of the potential for their discrimination and not even giving the person a chance to make a first impression. And so probably one of the more important interventions in this space is something called Ban the Box, which simply says that at the first stage of a job interview, the employer doesn't need to have a checkbox as to whether someone's got a criminal record.
They can ask that in an interview. That would be appropriate in your view.
That's right. The idea of Ban the Box is based off of this idea that the likelihood of getting a call back for an interview, even for the most entry-level position, drops off by half when someone says they have an arrest or a conviction history. What the fair hiring practices suggest is that you exclude this question from the initial application, and then if someone gets over that first hurdle, employers absolutely have the right to conduct background checks after that.
What do you think the impact is on the unemployment rate of having this kind of a number?
I think it's a very significant impact. One of the problems we have here is that this problem is somewhat invisible to the unemployment rate. You're actually leaving out a number of people who just aren't covered by these surveys, in no small part because of their interaction with the criminal justice system. I got into this issue very much in the spirit of what we're talking about. One of my primary goals in my work as an economist is trying to get the country back to full employment, a situation where we have a very tight job market and the number of job seekers is tightly matched to the number of jobs. Well, it pretty quickly occurred to me that we'll never achieve full employment unless we have a strategy for the literally tens of millions of people who face steep barriers to employment because of their criminal records. So that's what we're going after here.
Jared Bernstein is a former chief economist to Vice President Joe Biden and a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Reconnection Agenda, Reuniting Growth and Broadly Shared Prosperity. Some people with firsthand experience trying to find a job after prison understand that getting rid of a checkbox on a job application doesn't do much with so much information out in the public already. William Cobb is one of those people. He's the founder of Redeemed, an organization to eliminate systemic employment discrimination practice for ex-offenders. He's also the former vice president of the Ex-Offenders Association of Pennsylvania, and he joins us from Philadelphia. William, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good, good. And explain how simply getting rid of a checkbox is not really going to address the problem of systemic discrimination against ex-offenders.
Banning the box, as that's called, doesn't do much in terms of eliminating what the actual issue is, which is employment discrimination aimed at people living with arrest and convictions. In fact, in some cases, John, it lends to significant more frustration and despair for people who have been formally incarcerated or convicted.
Now, in your case, was there a ban the box law in Pennsylvania? And what impact did that have on your employment prospects?
8 years ago, nowhere near 90% of companies in America were conducting criminal background checks. So the advocates began to get that legislation passed, and ultimately we were successful in doing so. But by the time we were successful, John, the proliferation of criminal background checks had exploded as technologies improved and more companies had access to the internet. So now people in Philadelphia and other places where ban the box is already in existence have found that they're allowed to interview and the employer doesn't ask the question. And although they may be forthcoming about their criminal histories or their arrests, eventually it catches up with them. And employers still terminate their employment based on their criminal records.
So the argument that you can go into an interview and make a first impression, and then when a prospective employer does a criminal background check, that first impression will hold over the criminal record is wrong in your experience. It actually vetoes whatever impression you might have made in the interview.
That is absolutely correct, John. In my personal case, I've been hired and terminated well over a dozen times. Each time during the interview, I brought up the fact that I was arrested over 20 years ago, most recently, and that I had a criminal record. The company hired me. HR was aware of it. But upon actually receiving the record, the organizations at times had to have fights within their own organization where HR or the insurance company that protects the company from liability, can't seem to get on the same page. However, in Pennsylvania, there is legislation, and federally there's legislation that protects fair employment consideration rights for people living with arrest and convictions. The problem is that people living with arrest and convictions, employers, and even advocates who work with our population are unaware of it, just as I was until October of last year, which is when I decided to find Redeemed.
What kind of a criminal record are we talking about here with you?
Me personally, I was convicted of some violent offenses in 1994, ranging from robbery to violation of the Firearms Credit Act, which is a charge in Pennsylvania when you commit a crime with a gun.
Given that information, make an argument to me if I'm in some meeting with an HR person and the HR person says, you know, I want to hire this guy, William Cobb. And the HR person says to me, well, go ahead if you want to, but you're putting our entire company at risk, pal. You know, what do I say to that? What's my argument to that?
That's a great question. And pretty much it's this. Well, in viewing Mr. Cobb's resume, he appeared to be the best candidate of everyone that we interviewed. And in fact, that's why we selected him in the first place. But also, we need to consider the fact that his crime is not related to the nature of our business. And so therefore, the risks that we assume may be associated are not there. Also, we want to protect our company against any lawsuits filed on Mr. Cobb's behalf because we have violated his federal rights or his local and state rights. And also, we should check his character references. And if we do so, then the company will be protected. But also, we may find that we have a very, very valuable employee who's had an opportunity to develop some characteristics and traits that other employees may not have. So Mr. Cobb going to prison may not be a liability, but also may prove to be an asset for the company or organization.
Bill Cobb trying to get the word out there in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's a community activist and founder of the organization Redeemed, which is dedicated to eliminating systemic employment discrimination practice for ex-offenders. He's also the former vice president of the Ex-Offenders Association of Pennsylvania. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
So what good do you think banning the checkbox asking about criminal records would do? On Facebook, Lindsay Engels writes, I'm going to respond as an actual attorney who has worked on this project. The purpose of the movement is to end discrimination against former inmates who have served their time in the initial application process, where many qualified applicants are put aside because employers focus on the crime, not what the former inmate has done to improve his or her life and rejoin society. In the end, these citizens are able to gain employment, boosting the local economy, and helping them leave behind state and federal assistance.
Hi, my name is Danielle. I'm calling from Midtown. And I just wanted to say that I think police should always know when someone has a criminal record with any kind of violent offense, any kind of assault on someone, child molester or murder, anything like that. I think that should be public knowledge.
Bruce Ringier, Wantage Township, New Jersey. In a case of minor convictions, no. In the case of capital crimes, yes, but there should be a statute of limitations. After 10 years, if your record is clean, your conviction should be sealed. If you have paid your fine, served your time, and maintain a clean record thereafter, you should be allowed a clean start.
Or from Little Rock, Arkansas, it's a company's job to ensure the safety of their current employees and to protect the culture and reputation of the company itself. Facebook from Chris Morgan. As a police officer, I can tell you that a number of people I've encountered have stated that they've reoffended because they couldn't find reasonable employment, and I believe them. In my experience, many of those people you see soliciting and putting out handbills door-to-door are felons because they can't find other employment. We'd love to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway, and you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
How long will the United States keep Saudi secrets concerning the September 11th, 2001 attacks? 28 classified pages of a joint inquiry report made public back in December of 2002 were classified by then-President Bush. There have been reports that those pages contain information about high-level Saudi involvement in the financing of the attacks, that al-Qaeda members had contact with Saudi government officials in advance of the attacks. This week, Zacharias Moussaoui, a convicted al-Qaeda operative, testified that he had contact with the Saudi government in the weeks leading up to 9/11. Congressman Walter Jones, Republican from North Carolina, is the co-author of a bill, a renewed bipartisan effort, to get the president to declassify those 28 pages. Congressman Jones joins us from his home in Virginia. Congressman, welcome.
John, thank you.
What secrets do you think the Saudis have regarding 9/11?
John, that's the reason that Steve Lynch from Massachusetts and Thomas Massey from Kentucky and I have joined together to try to declassify the 28 pages that came when the 9/11 report came out. It was a congressional inquiry into what happened on 9/11. We have read the pages, and there's nothing in those pages about national security. It's simply information to help the 9/11 families and the American people better understand the role of the Saudis in 9/11. I can't go too much more into explaining because, again, this was classified information, and that's why we're trying to get it declassified.
Now, the New York Times reported back in 2003 that two Saudi citizens, at least that's what the Times says is in these 28 pages, two Saudi citizens had at least indirect links with two hijackers and may have been Saudi intelligence agents. Does what you've read go beyond that?
The 28 pages identify relationships, and there's a lot of information in the 28 pages that I should think shows associations. And I'm trying to be careful, as you can understand, since it's still classified. But the point is that there's nothing about national security.
If I'm a family member who lost somebody on September 11th and I read these 28 pages, what am I going to say? Am I going to say, aha? Am I going to say, so that's what happened or that's why it happened? What am I going to say?
That's why it happened. I would use that term that you just said. This will help them better understand how that 9/11 tragedy happened.
All right. I don't want to speak too much in code here, but you just said if a family member saw these 28 pages, they would say, ah, that's why it happened. So I'm concluding from that your read of those 28 pages is that September 11th would not have happened if something in Saudi Arabia hadn't taken place.
Well, I won't go that far. It was about the events that happened here in America prior to 9/11 and relationships and how those relationships connected.
You think this is going to happen?
Well, John, if the American people would join the families who are still in pain and call them member of Congress and the House and Senate and ask them to please join in this effort to call on President Obama to declassify the information, it should happen.
All right. Congressman Walter Jones, Republican from North Carolina, is co-sponsoring that resolution to urge President Obama to release the 28 pages classified from the congressional report on September 11th regarding Saudi Arabian connections with individuals involved in the attacks. Congressman, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Bob Marley, the reggae musical legend, would have turned 70 years old today. And the world he wanted only to overflow with peace and love hasn't quite made it there yet. Later in the show, we will talk with someone who knew Bob Marley for decades and has worked to keep his spirit alive. Although that spirit doesn't seem to need a whole lot of help.
I consciously heard his music probably about 5, 6. But my family and my people always play Bob, like, you know what I mean? And some the original Wailers. So it's like, it was an influence, a heavy, heavy influence early out.
That's young Jesse Royal, lead man of the King Sons, a reggae and hip-hop band. He's a young musician leading the reggae revival today in Jamaica for a whole new generation.
Bob Marley means so much on so many different levels to I and my generation. I mean, there's the musical aspect that, you know, I mean, we're very grateful that one like this did pass through Earth who saw it necessary to leave certain messages. Even though we are all vessels, but, you know, I mean, we still have to take that decision to follow the light. One like Bob who followed the light so diligently, you know what I mean, and kept it so upright, which is almost like a perfect example for we as youths today. On a spiritual level, you know how many minds he has opened up and how many people he has liberated. His works and words were in one line, so that is why he shines so bright.
Follow the light that shines so bright. Whether you buy into the practices of Rastafarianism or just love reggae music, Jesse Royal says, the life of Bob Marley was an example to be followed, and he is thrilled to be a part of a movement.
I'm truly honored to be a part of something substantial for my generation. You know what I mean? A generation that is pushing towards bringing forward that consciousness and bringing forward that awareness in the generation again to know ourselves, know what we have to do, and know what time it is, as I said. We've come a long way. Bob them and all of them put in so much work for it, but there's still a long way to go, you know what I mean? The amount of work that they put in makes it necessary for us to work.
Jamaican artist Jesse Royal and the King Sons are kicking off a U.S. tour. They play at the 9:30 Club in Washington, D.C. tonight with more dates around the country. Here's some Bob Marley trivia. He once worked at the DuPont Chemical Factory in Delaware. Did you know that? And Bob Marley's nickname when he was a bit younger than Jesse Royal there, growing up on the streets and villages of Jamaica, Tuff Gong. Later on, we'll hear from Roger Steffens, actor, author, broadcaster, photographer, and archivist who knew Marley for decades. He'll reflect on the man and the music. Later on, The Takeaway.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
And on Friday, we review movies here on The Takeaway, and we're here with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, where you have to know your Billy Joel song.
Strong Island, John.
Yeah, long and Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They co-host the Movie Date podcast, and we begin with Jupiter Ascending. It's the Wachowskis back again, the Matrix folks, and here's a clip from Jupiter Ascending.
I said it was in my genes. A defect of my genome engineering.
Explain a lot of things about me, like the fact that I have an uncanny ability to fall for men that don't fall for me. Maybe I have defective engineering too.
So the last Matrix movies were unwatchable. What about this?
I'm not sure this is any more watchable. You've got Mila Kunis there. She's a Chicago house cleaner who discovers that she's actually an intergalactic reincarnated queen.
Well, sure.
That's Channing Tatum playing Kane Wise, a half-wolf, half-man alien who's had his wings clipped, and he's got a pair of gravity boots that he's going to use to save Mila Kunis and whisk her off into the galaxy to reclaim her throne or something like that.
And down deep, Kristen, the moral here is...
The moral is, if your name is Eddie Redmayne and you're an Oscar nominee, be thankful that this movie came out in 2015, not 2014. Eddie Redmayne is also a main character in this movie. He's playing a villainous outer space royal family overlord who is horrible. This movie is horrible in every possible way. If we haven't already made that clear, Rafer and I did not like this movie.
Good special effects, though.
Oh, no, terrible. They're worse than any video game.
Those gravity boots that Channing Tatum is wearing, I don't know how they simulated that action, but it really slows him down and it makes him look like a real dolt in those action scenes. People howled their way through this screening. People were laughing from start to finish at this movie.
Yeah, there was mass hysteria in the theater.
Flash Gordon for the new millennium.
Jupiter chuckling, Jupiter descending, according to... Kristen and Rafer. Let's move to movie number two, Seventh Son.
Show me what you are! I paid good money for you. I think your father deceived me of your worth. Are you not the seventh son of a seventh son? You ought to be seven times as strong as a normal man.
You got Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore.
It sounds very dramatic.
Yes, it's another young adult adaptation. Jeff Bridges plays the spook. He's kind of a witch hunter, demon hunter. He gets Ben Barnes, who plays Tom Ward, to be his apprentice. And they go out searching for Mother Malkin, who's an evil witch, played by Julianne Moore. You've got a pretty good cast here, I think, which is part of what makes the movie work. It's not the most original stuff. It's not what you'd call the freshest material. But I think it kind of holds together. If you were, let's say, a 13-year-old kid, you might find this pretty fun.
Hunger Games, Name of the Thrones.
No, I don't even think a 13-year-old is going to like this, frankly. And I was really surprised. I thought, what is Julianne Moore, Oscar nominee, doing in this movie? What is Jeff Bridges, Oscar winner, doing in this movie? I do not understand why they're in this horrible movie. I will say this, if you like the kinds of medievalist, I'm wearing peasant blouses, I'm fighting with swords sort of experience, go watch some episodes of Xena instead. Xena does it better than this movie.
Xena. And our third movie, can you guess?
The Krabby Patty is what ties us all together. Without it, there will be a complete breakdown of social order. A war of all against all. Dark times are ahead. Dark times indeed.
Seriously? Aren't you overreacting a bit?
SpongeBob even gets into the act of this apocalypse?
That's right, yes. A little Mad Max apocalypse there in Bikini Bottom. Krabby Patties have gone missing and SpongeBob has to get them back. This is basically a extended bonus version of a half-hour SpongeBob episode. I think if your kids are a fan, if you're a fan, you'll get a chuckle out of it. I don't find a lot of heart or story here in SpongeBob, but there are some funny moments. Enough Simpsons-y humor, I think, to keep you placated.
On the podcast?
We're going to be talking about what we're watching on the small screen this week as well as the big screen. And on the small screen, Rafer and I are watching Black Mirror.
Well, have a great couch weekend, guys.
Thanks so much, John. You too.
Kristen Meinzer, our culture producer at The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, also a film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John. Thanks.
If you're sitting quietly right now, put your hand on your wrist and just feel your pulse. There. Got that rhythm. So the classic heartbeat, add the guitar and the bass, and there it is. Bob Marley, the frontman for the Human Heartbeat, the towering saint of reggae, would have turned 70 today. And on the street corners all over the world, in public squares where his likeness stands, there will be celebrations and remembrances. Sales of Bob Marley icons and t-shirts annually bring in reportedly $600 million. Marley is a musical freedom fighter, and as the chief prophet of the Rastafarian movement, is a religious figure as well. The self-taught Marley grew up on the streets of Jamaica, which may be why he seemed to think of everywhere as his home. One of his first bands was named The Teenagers, later The Wailers. Here's Bob Marley speaking to Jamaican DJ Neville Willoughby in his usual incomprehensible lilt.
It seems to me you put such a lot in your lyrics. Does it bother you that Jamaica people don't hear your lyrics as well as they should?
I say many shall be called, but only few chosen, right? And then the people have listened for the trumpet, which is not no trumpet to a complete. Man of God talks his imperial majesty.
Marley's musical lyrics, though, were clear as a bell. California DJ, filmmaker, and stalwart member of the counterculture, Roger Steffens, knew Bob Marley for decades.
His music meant something. It stood for something. It wasn't just pop fluff.
His early days, where was he brought up, and what did he arise out of in Jamaica?
His father was about 64 years of age when he was born, and his father was an outcast from a very wealthy white construction family in Jamaica. His mother was 18 when he was born, so there was a great disparity in their ages, and he never really knew his father. When he was five, his father came to Nine Mile and told his mother that he wanted to enroll Bob in a school in Kingston and give him a better chance at life. And instead, he abandoned him there. And for the next almost 2 years, Bob was an abandoned child on the streets of one of the worst slums in the Western Hemisphere. And I think that had a great deal to do with the empathy of his later poetry and lyrics for the sufferers, for people who were in that condition through an accident of birth. And it made him what he was in later years. It was the most important thing in his childhood.
And do you think his apparent disinterest in any kind of rules, I mean, he did things his own way, but at the same time, he wasn't a fighter. He wasn't necessarily a warrior, but he certainly didn't care for any structure or rules. And in some ways, that makes him very, very accessible, don't you think?
Well, he said every law on the face of the earth is illegal. Every government is illegal. Only Jah law pertains. And that was Jehovah. That was Jah Rastafari. That was Haile Selassie. He truly believed that Haile Selassie was the incarnation of God in our time.
Would you say Bob Marley is like a 20th century Sufi in the sense that he embraces music and art and religion in a way that's reminiscent of those times, but stands him pretty much alone in commercial music today?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful way to describe him, John. Yeah. You know, there was a wonderful book by a man called Hazrat Inayat Khan about 100 years ago. He was a mystic who played the veena, this ancient instrument, and he was supposed to be the finest exemplar ever of that musicianship. So he stopped playing. He said, if you want to achieve enlightenment, you have to give up that which you love most. But he talked about music alone can be the means by which the souls of races, nations, and families, which are today so apart, may one day be united. The more the musician is conscious of his mission in life, the greater service he can render to humanity. And he's really describing Marley there.
Stand up, life is your right.
Stand up for your right.
Without life, you can't fight.
Stand up,
keep the good time cold.
The song Get Up, Stand Up, who's he speaking to there?
It was an anthem for the freedom fighters all over the world. Get up, stand up for your rights, if you know what life is worth.
But if you know what life is worth,
you will look for yours on earth.
And now will you see the light?
He didn't believe in any pie in the sky God.
No woman.
How would you evaluate No Woman, No Cry in terms of his message and his movement?
Well, No Woman, No Cry was for all those people in the ghetto who lost their baby fathers, their husbands or their sons. It was a sound of solace. It was the kind of song you sang to yourself to get yourself out of a deep depression. And that's why I think it's one of his three or four most popular songs around the world ever.
Good friends we have, oh, good friends we've lost along the way. In this bright future, you can't forget your past. So dry your tears, I say.
And for a lot of us, Marley answered our problem of trying to find music that was really ennobling and worth listening to. I grew up on the first generation rock and roll on Alan Freed in New York, and I loved the doo-wop harmonies, and I loved the consciousness of the folk movement and Dylan in the 60s. But by the early 70s, the accountants and the lawyers had taken over the music business. And when I heard Bob in 73, it completely blew my mind. I couldn't believe that there was this huge body of work just a couple of hundred miles off America's shores, and we'd never heard about it before. Bob's music, it was 20th century hymns.
Compare the trajectory of Bob Marley with other pop musicians who we think of as absolutely timeless today.
Well, maybe you're talking about Elvis or Michael Jackson, Dylan. Marley is much more accessible to the heart, I think. I do a show called The Life of Bob Marley. I show a couple of hours of unreleased footage of Bob's life and tell his life story in between the clips. And virtually everywhere I do this around the world, someone will come up after the show and say, Mr. Steffens, I know you're not going to think I'm crazy when I tell you this, but Bob Marley's music literally saved my life. I don't think there are too many artists in the world who get that kind of response to their works.
And for you?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, my whole life changed. I read an article in Rolling Stone in 1973 by a gonzo journalist from Australia named Michael Thomas who said, reggae music crawls into your bloodstream like some vampire amoeba from the psychic rapids of upper Niger consciousness. And I said, man, I have no idea what that means, but I got to find this right away. And I was living in Berkeley, and my life was changed forever from that moment. It's been a reggae life.
All right, well, Roger, thanks so much.
One love.
One love.
One love.
Roger Steffens is a Bob Marley expert and reggae archivist. He's also the author of a new book, The Family Acid.
Feel all right. Hear the children cry.
Next week, we ask the question, what is beauty? And we'll kick off that exploration with a look at Greek definitions of beauty.
two questions always come up about beauty. One is, what kinds of things do people think are beautiful? The other is, what does beauty do? Does it make us admire something, or does it make us attracted to something?
What does your beauty do? Tell us your definition of beauty. Listen next week and tweet us at The Takeaway or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.